I say the house will come to order. The house will come to order. Please stand for the flag salute, which will be led by Representative Mitch Greenlick.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Today's opening ceremony will be presented by PSU opera singers, accompanied by Douglas Schneider, pianist from Portland, guest of Representative Nolan.
Thank you.
courtesies. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, wasn't that a wonderful way to start our morning session? Please join me in welcoming Portland State University opera singers Claire Craig Sheets and Anna Wehmeister and their accompanist on piano, Douglas Schneider. They will be performing together later in a production of Faust, and so if you would like more of that, please join us at Portland State for that performance. And colleagues, in the audience today, we also have the president of Portland State, Wim Wievel. Please make him welcome as well.
For our moment in history today, Representative Greg Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is Women's History Month. Sacagawea is the topic. This sesquicentennial history minute is from the Oregon Historical Society's online educational resources, the Oregon History Project, and the Oregon Time Web. Sacagawea was probably born in the late 1780s in present-day Idaho's Lemhi Valley. She was taken captive by Hidatsa raiders when she was around 12 or 13 and sold to a French-Canadian fur trader named Toussaint Charbonneau. The first reference to Sacagawea in the historical record is in November 1804, when the Corps of Discovery was wintering in the Knife River Indian villages near present-day Stanton, North Dakota. Sergeant John Ordway noted in his journal that he had met a French fur trader and his squaw, a derogatory term referring to Native women. At this time, the Shoshone teenager would have been several months pregnant with her first and probably only son, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. A few months later, Sacagawea, her newborn baby, and her husband left the Knife River villages with the Corps of Discovery on their journey westward. William Clark noted that she and her husband were hired to act as interpreter and interpretess for the Snake Shoshone Indians. The expedition journals make note of her service as an interpreter and mention that she pointed out familiar landmarks when they encountered Shoshone territory. There's little evidence to suggest, however, that she acted as the expedition's guide beyond recognizing Bozeman Pass as a good place to cross the Continental Divide. Little is known about Sacagawea after she and her husband left the expedition at the Knife River villages in August of 1806. There's been some controversy over the date and location of her death, but most scholars agree she probably died in 1812 at Fort Manuel in present-day South Dakota. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further courtesies, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it is my honor to introduce to you Callie Turner, who is the first honorary page from House District 42, my district. She is at Hosford Middle School, where she's in the seventh grade. Her interests include drama, soccer, softball, basketball, piano, music, and Spanish, so a well-rounded individual. And she's interested in performing a career in the performing arts, and I told her she would be able to witness a lot of drama in this chamber. Welcome, Callie.
Welcome to your state capital. Further courtesies, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's my honor today to introduce Brianna West. Could you stand up, Brianna? Brianna is the lovely daughter of my lovely committee administrator, Keely West, who will also stand right now. Brianna is interested in soccer, choir, Battle of the Books, piano, horseback riding, and she would like to be a forensic scientist. And she is from Leslie Middle School. Welcome, Brianna.
Welcome, Brianna, to your state capitol. Further courtesies, Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like colleagues today to introduce, this is the first time I've done this, I would like to introduce somebody who is an important part of my life. She is the administrative assistant to the district attorney of Deschutes County, Patty Hendricks. She's up here and she's here today. This is her first visit ever to the Capitol. So she's here for a civics lesson today, and she's going to be shadowing me all day and going to get a tour of the Capitol later on this afternoon. So welcome.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to your state capitol. Further courtesies, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I have the opportunity this morning to introduce a couple of our honorary pages as well, and I'd ask them to stand, please. First is Juliette Odell. Juliette is the daughter of Jill Odell, the legislative director in our office, and we're pleased to have Juliette here today. She lives in Beaverton and attends Oak Hills Elementary and is in the fourth grade. Her favorite activities are gymnastics, reading, writing, surprisingly, the Jonas Brothers, and animals. Her career goals include being an actress, a singer, or a veterinarian. Thank you for being here today. With her today is Quincy Neal, a friend. Quincy also is from Beaverton and attends Oak Hill Elementary in fourth grade. Her activities are Girl Scouts, music, sports, animals, and again, the Jonas Brothers, popular event. Her career goals are potentially in education and as an actress, and we welcome you both here today. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We hope you have a great day in the Capitol. Further courtesies, Representative Matt Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, colleagues. Hoping you'll welcome my honorary page today. Jessica Berry, will you stand up? Thanks, Jessica. Jessica is from Hillsboro and attends J.B. Thomas Middle School. Her interests include swimming, basketball, reading. She is an honor student, and her career goals are to be a lawyer, and it says comma judge, so I'm just going to ask Jessica to nod if she'd like to be a lawyer and a judge. Okay, so please welcome Judge Jessica Berry to the Capitol today. Thank you.
Welcome to your state capitol. Further courtesies, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I ask you to join me in welcoming two honorary pages today, sisters both, Claire Kessie and Abby Kessie. If you'd please stand up. Both of them are in the Scappoose School District. And Claire Kessie, age 11, is interested in writing, reading, starting a school newspaper, soccer, singing, acting, and 4-H. Meanwhile, her sister, Abby, raise your hand. There we go. Abby is age 13, in the Scappoose Middle School, and is interested in equestrian activities, soccer, basketball, baseball, 4-H, reading, and music. And her career goal is in education or animal training. Welcome to your capital, and thank you for joining us today and helping us out with this session.
Welcome, Abby and Claire, and once again, thanks to all of our honorary pages for being here today. Further courtesies, Representative Jefferson Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to welcome Kyle Cady, who is the Vice President of the student body at Portland State University. He's studying political science, is an intern in this chamber, in fact, in my office, plans on earning a master's in public policy. He says that he wants to dedicate his life to creating progressive and civically engaged society for the benefit of humankind. I think he is also a big fan of the Jonas Brothers.
Welcome to your state capitol. Further courtesies, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today in the gallery above me, we have three Albany Chamber of Commerce youth leadership students and their advisor. I'd like to introduce you to Maggie DeFore, Lydia Lush, Taylor Tipker, and their advisor, Karen Elliott, who are visiting the Capitol today from St. Am Christian High School. Welcome.
Welcome. We're glad you're here. Further courtesies, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to recognize the Yamhill Carlton girls basketball team, who cannot be here with us today because they're in the quarterfinals of the state championship, and they will be playing, or actually taking care of business against the Oregon Christmas Tree District today. The town of Malala will be under their wrath as they march to the state playoffs. So, thank you.
Further courtesies, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I would ask you to extend courtesies to my intern, James Foster, He's been working with me since the beginning of the session. Today being Viking Day, I finally prevailed upon him to be recognized. He's a student at Portland State University studying political science. He's going to graduate this June and hopes to enter a career in public policy. And he has seen nothing so far to dissuade him from that. And I thank you for that, colleagues.
Welcome. We hope you have a great day here. Further courtesies. Colleagues, we have a birthday in the chamber today. Representative Greenlick has turned 23.3 years of age Celsius. Happy birthday.
I have to figure this out.
Verification of quorum. The clerk will open the voting system to determine the presence of a quorum. Representative Buckley, excused, business of the House, excused, Representative Gilman and Shields, excused, business of the House, Representatives Cowan and Freeman. The quorum is present. Messages from the Governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform you that the Senate has passed Senate Bills 181, 202, and 605.
First reading, memorials and resolutions.
HJM 18, urging United States Secretary of Commerce to approve removal of California sea lions from Columbia River. HJR 33, proposing an amendment to Oregon Constitution relating to election campaigns. HJR 43, recognizing the importance of Oregon small business to Oregon economy.
Measures read first time are passed to the Speaker's desk for referral. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Propositions and motions. First reading of House bills.
House Bill 3297 relating to change to existing dwelling and exclusive farm use zones. House Bill 3298 relating to land reserves. House Bill 3311 relating to greenhouse gas emissions. House Bill 3316 relating to tax credit for parenting class and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3317 relating to tax credit for completing a marriage class and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3318 relating to tax credit for completion of first aid training course and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3323 relating to Oregon limited entry fishing guide program appropriate money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3324 relating to campaign finance. House Bill 3325 relating to recovery of medical services costs from injured workers. House Bill 3326 relating to definitions of terms concerning employment. House Bill 3327 relating to construction contractors and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3328 relating to quality education goals. House Bill 3329 relating to programs for senior citizens and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3338 relating to division of Marshall property. House Bill 3340 relating to nurses. House Bill 3347 relating to hospital charges and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3348 relating to search warrants and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3349 relating to school-based health centers. House Bill 3350 relating to venue. House Bill 3357 relating to environmental standards for educational buildings and property and money. House Bill 3359 relating to distressed home sales and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3366 relating to electrical meters in rental properties. House Bill 3367 relating to lighting fixtures and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3369 relating to water supply management of property and money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3370 relating to voluntary personnel income tax rate increase and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3376 relating to emissions. House Bill 3378 relating to lottery bonds for fuel cell systems for property and money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3379 relating to transportation of property and money and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3380 relating to safety net stability fund of property and money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3382 relating to agricultural control areas. House Bill 3383 relating to wolves. House Bill 3387 relating to tobacco taxes, appropriate money, prescribing an effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a three-fifths majority. House Bill 3388 relating to rights of residential care facilities. House Bill 3389 relating to tax force on mental health and addiction services for underserved population and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3390 relating to mental health services, appropriate money, and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3391 relating to long-term care services and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3392 relating to assets available to an institutionalized spouse in the determination of eligibility for medical assistance and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3393 relating to vehicle equipment. House Bill 3394 relating to private security professionals. House Bill 3395 relating to campaign finance and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3396 relating to diversion of service members with brain disorders resulting from military service. House Bill 3399 relating to vehicular homicide. House Bill 3400 relating to food, fish, and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3401 relating to public employee retirement and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3403 relating to payment of wage upon cessation of employment. House Bill 3404 relating to public financing of campaigns for state public officers and appropriating money. House Bill 3405 relating to state financial appropriating money, prescribing an effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a 3/5 majority. House Bill 3409 relating to tolling of interstate bridges. House Bill 3410 relating to school finance and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3411 relating to tax credits and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3412 relating to income taxation, prescribing an effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a 3/5 majority. House Bill 3413 relating to appointment of business income for taxation purposes, prescribing an effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a 3/5 majority. House Bill 3414 relating to charitable checkoffs and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3415 relating to carbon tax appropriating money, prescribing an effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a 3/5 majority. House Bill 3418 relating to reimbursement for health care delivered through an integrated health home model and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3419 relating to traffic signal modules. House Bill 3420 relating to public contractors of software procurement. House Bill 3421 relating to contracts for service for the Department of Corrections. House Bill 3422 relating to Department of Transportation public contracts. House Bill 3423 relating to sex offenders. House Bill 3424 relating to reporting child pornography. House Bill 3425 relating to the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. House Bill 3426 relating to School Improvement Fund. House Bill 3427 relating to criminal record checks for schools. House Bill 3428 relating to alcoholic liquor. House Bill 3429 relating to state medical assistance program and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3430 relating to elections. House Bill 3431 relating to signatures on initiative petitions for state measures and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3432 relating to voter registration and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3433 relating to elections. House Bill 3434 relating to ballots and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3435 relating to legal presence. House Bill 3436 relating to public assistance. House Bill 3437 relating to agriculture experiment stations. House Bill 3438 relating to motorcycles. House Bill 3439 relating to criminal aliens. House Bill 3440 relating to immigration. House Bill 3441 relating to water measurement. House Bill 3442 relating to water conservation. House Bill 3443 relating to large woody debris. House Bill 3444 relating to tax credits. House Bill 3445 relating to alternative energy. House Bill 3446 relating to alternative energy appropriating money and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a 3/5 majority. House Bill 3447 related to non-motorized boat registration. House Bill 3448 related to ballot measure 49-2007. House Bill 3449 related to discrimination based on certain physical characteristics. House Bill 3451 relating to ballots.
All bills dropped as of the deadline have now been first read. We'd like to thank Legislative Council for their hard work in achieving that. Bills read first time are passed to the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 2080 relating to gray water and declaring an emergency.
Bill read second time is passed to third reading. Consent calendar. Third reading of House bills. The clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2466 relating to administrative rule review by Legislative Council and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of House Bill 2466. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I guess there's some honor in having institutional knowledge of this process, and this being my fourth term, I'm going to give you a little bit of a history. My first term, I was assigned to the Legislative Council Committee. I had no idea what that was. Walked in, sat down, and sat with peers as the Legislative Council brought in their counsel, our counsel, who sat with agency folks and basically had a review of rules that were in dispute. In other words, Legislative Council during the interim had gone back through the rulemaking process, and where they thought the agency had made a rule that did not conform to what council felt was our intent or did not do what we thought it was supposed to do, they would bring in the agency before this committee and we would hear this review of these disputed rules. It was a very interesting exercise in finishing the process that we start here when we write a statute. But the really interesting thing about it was the committee had no authority to change those rules. Is all it did was make us aware that there was a dispute over these rules. There was no authority, there still is not, and there is not in this bill, to actually change the rule.
but it was very informative of the process, and I learned a lot. It was also a very time-consuming process for Legislative Council, and over the course of my history in this building, we have seen massive changes in personnel, in institutional knowledge. We've had, I think I'm on my fourth Leg Council since I've been here. And this process has fundamentally broken down. We have also been meeting more frequently, which drives their workload. Last year we met in a winter session. So this function has broken down in a substantive way. And this bill was brought to us by our Legislative Council as a way of restarting that process in a more intelligent way, and I hope you'll subscribe. Basically, what this does is, instead of it going to a special Legislative Council committee, these rulemaking reviews would go to the interim substantive committee that is concerned with that area of law. This makes a lot of sense on a lot of levels. Presumably, these committee members are more aware of the issues around these policies and the agencies and what they do. So the Leg Council is directed to divvy up these rule reviews according to those interim committees, and they would be heard, these rule review disputes would be heard by the interim committees. I think this would make a lot of sense to get this moving forward. But in the meantime, we have a backlog of about 4,500 of these rules that have been made that have not yet been reviewed. This bill would wash those out of the system. Be aware that Leg Council doesn't have the time to do this. A lot of those rules that were made in this period between the last time this committee met and going forward, a lot of those rules were temporary rules that aren't even relevant at this point. And frankly, we need to start moving forward on this and get it jump-started. We cannot get to those if we're going to be going as often as we are and using our council effectively for its main role. And also remember that even if you hear these rule reviews in a interim committee, you will have no power to change the rules. Okay? That's an important point. But what it does give you as a member of those interim committees is the authority to go forward and say, well, we better talk about this statute because clearly our rules are not doing our business. It gives the committee a chance to move forward and think about it. I will also tell you, when I sat on Leg Council, the rulemaking process. There are thousands of these rules. They're being created all the time. And when I did sit on a Legislative Council committee, there was a very, very, very small percentage that was actually under review or dispute. So it wasn't like they're all disputed all the time. So I think this is a very workable way of getting this process going again. Makes a lot more sense to have policy committees in the interim working on these things. And I would urge your aye vote, and I would welcome any questions that you may have.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Berger, do you wish to close?
Apparently not. Please vote aye.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Cameron, how do you vote? Cameron votes aye. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Clem votes aye. House Bill 2466, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2588, relating to agreement among the states to elect the president by national popular vote.
The The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2588, Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it's a real honor and privilege to be bringing to you today a bill that I think may be one of the more fascinating bills we deal with this session, and potentially one of the more important ones as well. This bill, House Bill 2588, would contribute to a state-based movement to change the way that we elect the United States President. If this bill passes, and it passes in enough other states, we would, as a country, select the President on the basis of the national popular vote rather than the state-by-state allocation of Electoral College votes based on the winner of the vote within each of those states. So let me say a little bit more about how this would work and why we might take it up in Oregon. As you know, the U.S. Constitution allows each state to determine the method by which we select our electors. Repeat that again. The U.S. Constitution allows each state to decide how to designate its electors. And in Oregon, as you know, we designate all seven of our electors to the winner of Oregon's popular vote. Most other states, but not all, do it the same way. There are a couple of states where that designation is done proportionally based by congressional district. This bill would enter Oregon into an interstate compact that would direct the top election official in our state, as well as the other state signatories to the compact, to certify the electoral slate associated with the winner of the national popular vote. In other words, Oregon's electors would be directed to cast their electoral college votes for the winner of the national popular vote. This would have the effect, when ratified by a majority of states, majority of electoral states whose electors represented a majority of the electoral college, this would have the effect of making the winner of the national popular vote the U.S. president. So why would we go about it? Well, fundamentally, this is about fairness. In four out of our nation's 56 elections of a president, the candidate who received fewer popular votes, won the election. Of course, most famously and most recently, this occurred in 2000. But we also came very close to this scenario in 2004, where a difference of just 60,000 votes in the state of Ohio would have made John Kerry the U.S. president, despite the fact that he would have lost the national popular vote by 3.5 million. This would, if this compact is ratified, this would ensure that candidates are forced to campaign across the country, not just in a few battleground states. Let me give you some statistics. 98% of all the money spent by presidential candidates in 2004 and 2008 were spent in just 16 states. Just 16 states that received 98% of the dollars and attention of the major party candidates. How about where they spent their time? Again, in 2004 and 2008, just six states received more than two-thirds of the visits from our major presidential party candidates. Safe states, whether big or small, Republican or Democrat, urban or rural, are essentially ignored by the major party candidates for president. This includes 12 of the 13 smallest states in the country that are safe states, half of them Republican, half of them Democrat, typically, as well as 6 of the 10 largest states in the country that are essentially safe states. And this has the effect of skewing what candidates talk about, skewing their priorities potentially when they are in office. Presidential candidates spend time discussing issues important to swing states, to the Ohios, the Floridas, the Pennsylvanias of the world, less time and attention on issues that are important to states like Kentucky, like Arkansas, and perhaps like Oregon. What is
the impact on voter turnout? Well, it turns out it's pretty significant. Voters in safe states are 10% less likely to vote if they live in a state safe. Young voters are 17% less likely to vote if they live in a state's safe state than their battleground state counterparts. Again, this is about ensuring the fairness, the honesty, I think the openness and trustworthiness of the way that we elect our national president. I think there's a reasonable question, sort of, why is this legislature taking up this issue at this time, given all the challenges that we face in our state and certainly in our country? And I guess I'd make the case that this bill does matter a lot to this moment, and it goes something like this. We really do face extraordinary challenges locally as a state, nationally. Problems like our expanding national debt, the unsustainability of our health care system, the economic struggles that so many find themselves in, and the incapacity of the state of Oregon in many ways to meet those challenges. And I certainly don't have the answers to those problems, but I do know that we will be incapable of addressing those challenges, of fundamentally redesigning the things that need to be redesigned and taking on the hard problems that need to be taken on, if the public doesn't believe that the system is fair, that the government that they elect represents them. Public trust in the system is absolutely vital if we're going to have a shot at coming together to deal with the really tough stuff. So this bill, of course, is just about presidential elections, but it would go a long way, I believe, in increasing the public's confidence that our political system is fair. And polling on this has consistently, since the 1940s, shown overwhelming public support for electing our president via the national popular vote. So it's not that the public will always agree with the outcomes that we produce, but if we elect a president in a process that's fair, that makes sense to the public, if they believe that the process is transparent, the playing field's level, then we may have a shot. So that's my case for this bill. I hope there are questions. It's a interesting fact. When I first heard about this approach a couple years ago, it took me certainly a few minutes, maybe a few days, to wrap my mind around how this would actually work. But I think it would take us a long way towards realizing ultimately the aspirations of our founders and the best intentions of this great system. Thanks very much.
Further discussion. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the gentlelady from West Salem, who is a member of the House Committee on Rules, who I thought was the carrier of the bill.
Does Representative Berger yield?
She does.
She does.
Good representative. Do I understand that a member of your household tried to convince you that you should oppose this bill?
Good representative from Central Oregon?
Rural Deschutes County.
Rural Deschutes County. Sometimes we aren't in total agreement with all of our constituents on every issue. And there is a certain constituent who I've been married to for 39 years, who has a contrary opinion on this bill. I am in the queue, and I will give my opinion. And I always like to respond to my constituents in this case that, yeah, there can be contrary opinions, but I've got the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Another question of the gentlelady from West Salem.
Further question. Do you yield?
I do yield, and these questions were given me ahead of time.
Good representative, would you mind explaining to this body, because I know you're the member of your household, and how intelligent he is and how responsible he is, and his he's an educator. Could you please tell us, give us one main reason of why he opposed this bill?
Thank you for the question. His objection to this bill was his sometimes irrational notion that any change needs to be looked upon suspiciously, and this is a change in electoral politics, and he is very conservative in his views of how the Electoral College should operate, and believes that this change was not necessary or to his liking.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, I have another question from the gentlelady from West Salem.
Does Representative Berger yield?
I do.
She does.
Good representative. Could you please tell this body if your committee or you requested an opinion from the Attorney General or the Legislative Council questioning if House Bill 2588 violates U.S. Constitution concerning interstate compacts?
Thank you for that very serious question. We did not request, as a committee, advice of counsel on this issue. We heard testimony from both the proponents and opponents of this on this issue. The opponents feel that it is a violation of constitutional provisions. The proponents very much disagree and say that it is not. It is one of those things that, as this moves forward, will certainly be further discussed, and I appreciate the question.
Thank you, good representative. Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, one Saturday recently, I came to this chamber dressed as a frontiersman from the good city of Farewell Bend. I feel today I should have come dressed as Thomas Jefferson. Okay, you've heard. National popular vote. Every vote counts. The candidate with the most votes wins. We want the candidates to visit Oregon. We want to be important. The Electoral College is outdated at this time, and we need to move forward. Colleagues, fact. We are not a direct democracy, but a constitutional republic. The Founding Fathers studied this issue and rejected the concept of direct election of the president. You and I are elected representatives to vote for our constituents. In fact, in the conference room next to my office, many of you are meeting to take away the direct vote of Oregonians by changing the initiative process. This seems like a conflict of principles and ideas. Fact, the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, defines the Electoral College. It was later amended by the 12th Amendment. The Electoral College has been in place for all 56 presidential elections. I believe in tradition. I am proud of our Constitution and respect the wisdom of our Founding Fathers. However, we have a system to change the Constitution. We've changed the Constitution. But in fact, over the years, Congress has rejected more than 1,000 constitutional amendments that would have changed the Electoral College. A fact, this bill calls for Oregon to join a compact for agreement among the states to elect the president by national popular vote. Are we having another civil war? Fact, House Bill 2588, Section 1 states, the agreement among the states to elect the president by national popular vote is hereby enacted into law and entered into on behalf of this state with all the other states legally joining in the compact. And legality may be a question. Fact, the bill binds Oregon to giving our electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote nationally. Fact, House Bill 2588, Article 4 states the agreement shall terminate if the Electoral College is abolished. That's what this bill's doing, abolishing the Electoral College. Fact, four states have passed the compact: California, Hawaii, New Jersey, and Maryland. However, California Governor Schwarzenegger and Hawaii Governor Lingle vetoed the bill. Governor Schwarzenegger did not like the fact that California's electoral votes could go to the candidate who actually lost in California. How can this be a good idea if only four states have agreed to this political plot? And we heard from the carrier that this is going to bring the candidates to Oregon. Fact, Oregon's share of the national popular vote's 1%. I suspect that Oregon would get about 1% of the presidential candidates' attention. However, with seven electoral votes, we can be a player in close contest. If we really want to be a player in the campaigns, we should consider moving up our primary elections. Look at the attention in the primaries that the small states of Iowa and New Hampshire get with small populations. And colleagues, fact, more than one half of the nation's population lives in just 9 states. More than one half of the nation's population lives in the 40 largest urban areas. The wonderful press has reported that Democrats are mad about the system after Bush won in 2000, but they may feel better about the Electoral College now that President Obama was elected. Republicans may fear that the national financial backing of this bill is trying to pull a fast one, since the financial backer is a big donor to the Democrats. Colleagues, fact, the Electoral College represents the separation of and balance of power and authority between the states.
Representative Wingard yields.
Thank you, Representative. The Electoral College respects the separation of and balance of power and authority between the states and the federal government. Fact, under the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, a state's electoral votes could be awarded to a candidate the majority of the citizens did not vote for. For example, Californians who supported John Kerry in 2004 by a popular vote would have seen all their electoral votes go to George W. Bush because they're in the compact. Remember, this is the reason Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed the bill. Fact, former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Democrat in New York, argued that abolishing the Electoral College would be the most radical transformation in our political system that has ever been considered because it would severely weaken the two-party system. With the national popular vote, more candidates will enter the race, and the winner could be decided by who gets the most votes. The result could be a winner of a very small percentage of the vote. The good carrier talked about the 2000 election. Colleagues, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the presidency with only 43% of the popular vote. Yet the 57% of the people who voted for the other two candidates had only to look at his 720 electoral votes to know that he was the nation's choice for president. Fact. The U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, prohibits any state without the consent of Congress from entering into an agreement or compact with another state. Is HB 2588 legal? The good gentlelady from West Salem could not confirm that it had a legal interpretation. I'm moving towards closing. I've added another page since last night, but by quoting a very conservative newspaper, the Los Angeles Times. But their article supports my position that this is not a good move for Oregon. Let me quote from the LA Times, my favorite magazine. This kind of ill end run, the national popular vote, is necessary because the only way to get rid of the Electoral College entirely is via constitutional amendment, which is nearly impossible to pass. Enough small states, like Oregon, benefit from the current system to block an amendment. End of quote. Colleagues, this is my fourth term, my third session as a member of this honorable legislative body. Most of you know I don't speak a lot about a lot of bills. And I guess I've never seen a floor speech change the expected vote by this chamber. But I hope that my speech, with more facts than opinions, have provided you enough doubts about this bill to reconsider your support, even for those good friends who sponsored the bill or those who have committed their vote to the advocates for this bill. Remember that LA Times, that great newspaper, reported the Electoral College benefits states like Oregon. I submit this bill, the national popular vote, would make small population states like Oregon obsolete and give national decision makers power to Americans' urban centers. Supporters of the national popular vote movement claim that their system would force candidates to go to less populated rural areas. Logic and history simply don't support this claim. Candidates have no reason to pay attention to states like Wyoming, Nevada, Utah, North Dakota, South Dakota. Combined, if they could win just as many votes by visiting New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. The Electoral College can be hard to understand. Part of the reason is that people are not familiar with the system, but it functions seamlessly, and we've never had to think about it. This is a bad reason for overhauling Thomas Jefferson's 200-year-old institution. Some claim the Electoral College is outdated. Unity, stability, security, freedom, and giving a voice to each member of our national community, these are never outdated.
Representative Bruin yields.
Thank you, Representative. This is what the Electoral College has provided America for the last two centuries. I further submit that changing the U.S. Constitution is an issue the people of Oregon did not elect us to make for them. Yes, we can pass this bill to abolish the Electoral College established by the U.S. Constitution, but is that what the people of Oregon want its elected officials deciding for them? Colleagues, please join me to stop this end-run attempt by the U.S. Constitution to abolish the Electoral College, which benefits states like Oregon. Please vote no on House Bill 2588.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, colleagues. I am a co-sponsor of this bill. I rarely get into disputes with my number one, policy disputes with my number one constituent. I freely admit in this case we had a sort of a weekend's argument over this. Nevertheless, I remain committed to this proposal, and let me tell you why. I have become very impatient with our presidential electoral process, and here's why. 50% of Oregon's land mass is controlled by the federal government. You would hope that a landlord would pay a lot more attention to his property and manage it wisely. Instead, however, we are a small 1%, the 1% state, easily neglected. Part of the problem is that during election time, when all issues are put on the table, we simply don't count. Florida counts, Ohio counts, Pennsylvania counts, Oregon, not so much. This proposal would help change that dynamic. By banding with other small states, California aside, they're going to get attention in California. But there's a lot of us who need to get together to get bigger. And by banding with other small states to be sure of our electoral votes are cast for the popular vote winner, we will be on the map during presidential elections. We all know how sophisticated elections have become. In key states, there are armies of pollsters and message testers out there measuring the issues that concern us as citizens. We need to get our issues on the radar. We bring incredible natural resources to the national table, from our wheat, our fish, our water, our hydroelectric energy, and especially our forests. We are heavily impacted at the national level. And we need to get the attention of the power players in Washington in order to have intelligent management of these resources and cooperatively with us. Let me talk just a minute about the constitutional issue, because this was brought up in committee, and the proponents point out that the Electoral College is not abolished. Electoral votes are still counted under this scheme. And the U.S. Constitution clearly says that the states have the power to choose these electors. So we would be choosing our electors. We would simply be, as a state, saying those electors are going to go to whoever wins the popular vote. Another positive about this proposal that appeals to me in a great way is that it is not constitutional here in Oregon either. It is a statutory change to enter into this compact with other states. If this does not work out, we can back out. If this doesn't work, we aren't committed in a constitutional sense to this proposal. I say let's give it a try. We need more attention to our issues on the national stage. This is a positive step in that direction, and I support it, despite one constituent's complaints. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Mr. Speaker, I want to confine my remarks to the constitutional issues that have been raised this morning, because I think it's important that the legislature, that the House understand what these issues are, as I understand them, and what they mean in the case of this particular piece of legislation. I want to note that the Constitutional Convention of the United States, when it was trying to figure out how to elect a president, faced a very interesting problem. And that is that the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, are the only office holders that are elected nationwide. All other officers are elected in the various states. And so at the time, they were faced with the reality that the determination of who could vote in a state was different in each state. Each state had its own rules about that. Some states required property ownership, others did not. Some states required other provisions for qualifying to be an elector. If you had a popular vote based on nationwide, based on those different differences, states that had more expansive electoral rules, that is, allowing a larger percentage of the population to vote, would gain an advantage over other states simply by that fact alone. So instead, they came to the conclusion of establishing a rule such as the one that we are discussing, the Electoral College. Now, the point that I want to make about that issue is that the convention, and then finally adopted by the various states, is found in Article 2, Section 1, as the member from Rural Deschutes County pointed out. It is the second paragraph of that sentence that is the controlling paragraph, and then the fourth paragraph also refers to it. And the second paragraph says, each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which that state may be entitled in the Congress. That's the operative part of that. And notice, the issue here is that the legislature makes the decision. So the representative from East Salem is exactly correct that the legislature adopts this by law, and it's not because of anything in the Oregon Constitution or the Oregon law that requires that. It's because the United States Constitution says that the legislature shall determine how electors are to be chosen. Then finally, to complete the thought, in the fourth paragraph of the same article, it says, Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the date on which they shall give their votes. Nothing in this bill changes any of those things or denies those requirements. It establishes by state law how the electors will be chosen, and it does nothing to interfere with Congress's power to determine the dates of their choosing, of their being chosen, or of the time that they cast their votes. Now, you'll notice there's nothing in this section or in the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, which refers to the requirement that president and vice president be elected separately rather than on the same ballot. There's nothing in any of those that tells how the legislature is to do that, what the legislature's law must say. There's nothing that would prevent a legislature from directly electing the electors if it so chose to do that, for example. Now, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States establishes the rights of citizens of the United States, and all the lawyers in the chamber are very familiar with this, so I won't belabor the point, except to say that as a result of that, we now have essentially common requirements for voting across the United States. And so the decision that was made by the Founding Fathers might not be the same today as it was at the time, because the rules of the different states were all very different. Colleagues, this is a very clever way of making certain that a popular winner of the United States popular vote is actually elected President of the United States and Vice President of the United States. If this actually is enacted by enough states to get to the 270 electoral votes to control that election, then it would be a good thing. I will point out that there have been several elections, including the one in 2000, but in 1876 there was another equally divisive election in which the non-popular vote winner actually won the election for president because of a controversy that took quite some time to resolve. The result of that is that we end up with machinations like the machination in Florida, the requirement of the Supreme Court to act on Bush versus Gore.
Representative Harker yields.
Thank you, Representative Harker. I appreciate that. And this rule, if it were adopted by the required number of states, would obviate that. In none of those elections was there a controversy about who actually won the popular vote. In none of those elections was there a controversy over who actually won the popular vote. The separation was hundreds of thousands of votes or millions of votes between the candidates that won the popular vote and the candidate that actually received the electoral vote. But in all cases in which the electoral vote went to somebody other than the popular vote winner, there were controversies about the outcome of elections in particular states that controlled the outcome of the electoral vote. Colleagues, this is a great idea. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I'm not going to try to repeat a 15-minute discourse on the Constitution of the United States, nor on how to change the Constitution of the United States. I'd simply like to ask you to think about this bill and try to divorce, in some ways, this constitutional issue. Though the point is made by proponents and opponents of it. First off, it strikes me that this bill is a bill out in search of a problem. You've already heard from a number of the speakers that we've gone through many elections for president, and generally, even though some of us have disagreed with the how some of the outcomes might have gone, we might have preferred that they would go in another direction. Generally, the country has survived the election process and done so quite well. But I would like to talk a little about the Founding Fathers and the intentions that they had. Many of which are not necessarily germane today because we've come a long ways since that time. Some of which, however, still are. One of those issues has been brought up in terms of size, population. Interesting that one of my illustrious colleagues has tried to, from Salem, West Salem, I think, tried to, you know, make that point about how this would, this bill would advantage the us because of our size. And if I'm reading this correctly, there's some, we're taking some offense that we don't get the national attention during elections that we think we deserve. As you think about this bill and vote on this, you know, you may want to be careful. You may get what you ask for. And for those of you who have some type of dish or what have you, television that get national media during election time, you know, that covers these races, you may appreciate that you'd just as soon not have quite so much national attention with it. However, the issue of size, one of the real fundamental problems that appeared in colonial history was in dividing up the powers and establishing the governments, it even early in our history was obvious that some states with large population bases would have a decided advantage. And there was a considerable amount of discussion on more issues than we want to go into about that topic. And as a consequence, the system that was designed for elections was to try to minimize that advantage that large population bases would have in that election process. We complain that we don't have the opportunity to have all of the discussions here in Oregon. But I think the national debates, I think the point has been made that there are some small states that did have, that did receive a lot of attention. I originate from, you know, or claim to originate from the state of Montana.
Representative Schaffler yields.
Thank you, Representative. Montana has a less electoral votes than we have. And Montana's kind of an enigma sometimes as far as its politics are concerned, but you know, interestingly, they oftentimes tend to go Republican, though on a statewide level, sometimes on state issues, they sometimes tend to, you know, go the other way. But, the size wasn't the issue in the last election as far as Montana was concerned. The issue was that Montana was not a given for either candidate. Oregon was. Nobody had anything to gain by coming to Oregon. Didn't have a lot to gain by coming to Montana, but they did have three votes they might gain or lose if they failed to come. I think New Mexico fell in somewhat the same category of having considerable attention in the last election. Oregon did not. Size was one of the variables, and coming from the part of the state that has less numbers than where some of you all, districts you all come from, I can be pretty sympathetic with the advantage on a state level as far as size is concerned, and I'd be sympathetic with it on a national level. And try to protect the balance of power between the big and the small as such. The other thing, the statement was made that we don't have any, choosing of our electors. and that somehow this would give us the opportunity to choose our electors. And my response to that is simply, no, 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 it wouldn't do that. It would do exactly the opposite of that. If we sign on to this and become a part of this compact of states, our electors will not be determined by our 3/5 vote for one candidate. They will be determined by whether one candidate receives a majority, 50 plus one, 50% plus one, nationwide. So this is not a bill to in any way guarantee us that our electors are going to be determined by us. It does exactly the opposite. It determines that our electors, the electors from Oregon, are going to be determined by the mass votes that come out of California, New York, Ohio, Texas, Florida, etc. Is that where you really want to go? But my main objection, my main problem in opposing this legislation is I think it deprives me, Oregon, it deprives Oregon from the real right of a protest vote. One of the things that I cherish as a member of the minority party here, I cherished for the other party when I served in the majority, the right to make protest votes and to have those protest votes heard, recorded, and observed. We could vote 2/3 to 3/4 for one given candidate who loses the national popular vote by one vote and have our reason for not supporting that candidate completely eliminated in the whole scheme of the national scene. I don't want to give up
Speaker
my
Hunt
right
yields
for that protest vote. Thank you, Representative. I don't think you do. I think if you think seriously about that, that's something you value and cherish. And it's something that has made this country great in the past, and I suggest will probably continue to do so. So no, no, no. This does not, underline, absolutely does not guarantee that our electors being those people that the majority of Oregonians vote for, not the majority from New York, California, Texas, Florida, etc. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A question of the good representative from rural Deschutes County.
Does Representative Wisnett yield?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, he does.
My good colleague, am I to imply from your line of questioning that the person who makes decisions in the Wisnett household would be Mrs. Wisnett?
There's no doubt. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. After that, I'm not sure I want to rise in front of the body. Colleagues, I rise today because I wanted to just share my name is on this bill, but I sent a letter into the chief clerk's office to remove my name, explain my vote, because I love this process. And one of the things about this process is you get to hopefully hear from both sides of the story.
And as I went through this session, and even before this session, and even up to today's floor debate, I'm listening. And so I will be a no vote today, and I wanted to explain why that vote will show up, but you might see my name because I've asked it to be removed from the bill, and it will eventually when it's reprinted. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Jefferson Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will just say I agree and am persuaded by Representative Jensen that this bill will not, on average, with any likelihood, increase Oregon's influence in the national political discussion, nor do I think this bill, however, will decrease it. I think, unfortunately, due to our political makeup and population, we are where we're at. And therefore, I think we can be free to make a judgment based on what do we think the most sensible system is for selecting a president behind a veil of ignorance for the country. And therefore, I will be supporting this bill, despite, I think, your excellent arguments, and we should be looking for other ways we can have an impact on the national political conversation. My good friend, Representative Wisnant, I'm not using my yellow card, I apologize for that, from rural Deschutes County, I agree with you that Thomas Jefferson helped set forth this system. He also said that every generation or so, we ought to have a revolution. Here's a little baby one.
Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I wasn't planning on standing, and I'm sorry. I just wanted to touch on a couple of points that the good representative from rural Deschutes County didn't discuss, and one is recounts. What about recounts? The national popular vote people, I've heard, say that the need for recounts wouldn't really be there. But who's to say that the national popular vote wouldn't produce a close race? What would be the process? Can you imagine the mess it would be to conduct a national recount under the national popular vote? Now, under the Electoral College, it's messy enough, but the mess is usually confined to one or two states. We've seen the litigation that can result from close races. There could be lawsuits flying all over the nation about voting hours, voting machines, processes, hours, ballot styles, hanging chads. We've all heard it. And it would be all over the nation. It wouldn't be just one or two states. What about getting visited by candidates? What under this bill would suddenly give us a bigger voice than we have now? The good representative talked about it actually diminishing our voice. There's no guarantee that the state of Oregon would suddenly show up on the list of states to visit just because we signed on to this compact. Instead, I believe it's a rearranging of deck chairs, tilting favor to the larger states, taking away our independence and individuality, and I can't help but think of it, but forcing us into being assimilated into the Borg. For instance, all of Oregon's votes in 2004, we, as a state, supported John Kerry, and all those votes instead would have been absorbed into the Borg of George W. Bush. And if the goal here is to add more fairness and have one man, one vote, one woman, one vote, I believe that the supporters of this bill have been misled. Thanks.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Shoffler. You yielded your time to Representative Jensen. Representative Widener yields. Having yielded, you're no longer in the queue, but with the queue, no one in the queue, you can speak a second time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. That's democracy in action. I guess it's kind of to the bill. You know, we got stuck with George Bush even after a recount.
Go ahead, Seth. Further discussion. Seeing none, Representative Cannon, do you wish to close?
I do, Mr. Speaker.
This has been a great debate. Colleagues, I really appreciate the honor and seriousness with which this debate has been conducted. I think it's an issue and topic that deserves that level of treatment, and I really respect all members for their contributions to this, including people with whom I disagree here. Let me address some of the issues that came up. And first of all, the constitutionality of this approach, and I think it's already been treated well by several others who spoke in favor of this, but let me just mention that we did not receive the LC memo that we might have expected to receive if our legislature's attorneys considered this bill to be problematic constitutionally, nor can we assume did the legislatures and governors of the four states that have already adopted this interstate compact, Hawaii, Maryland, Illinois, and New Jersey. It was said that the Electoral College has been in place for all 56 elections, and let me speak to the tradition here because I think that's an important issue to raise. Yes, of course, the Electoral College has been in place since the election of our very first president. However, the method by which we've designated electors, the method by which the Electoral College works, has changed over the years. In fact, this winner-take-all system that most states, including Oregon, use to assign their electors was not the way electors were assigned initially. That was an evolution that took place over decades. Let me talk about attention to Oregon and attention to small states, how this may or may not change the way presidential campaigns treat their priorities. I think it's certainly a point for speculation and debate and reasonable difference of opinion. But let me just make a couple of factual points. First of all, the vast majority of America's population lives in suburbs and rural areas, not big cities. So if we're concerned about the attention that might get paid to big cities under a one-person, one-vote popular vote system, I think we have that fact on the other side. The 12 small, safe states, the ones that are pretty assuredly in either the Republican or Democratic column, have 11 million total population, and they have 40 total electoral votes. Ohio, one state, also has 11 million people, and it only has 20 electoral college votes. This gets it, I think, the good representative from Umatilla was describing in his effort to explain that the Electoral College is designed to help assure favorable treatment for small states. So 11 million people in Ohio, 20 electoral votes, 11 million people in 12 small states that are safe, 40 electoral votes. Yet those small states received virtually no attention in 2004 and 2008. Ohio, with half the electoral college total, received a huge amount of attention because it was a swing state. So fundamentally, this is about aspiring that presidential candidates do more than pay attention to those few critical battleground states that we're oh so familiar with from the last several presidential campaigns. The notion of a protest vote, I think this is an interesting and important idea, the idea that we can register in Oregon our protest vote when we differ from the national current. But again, the principle here is one person, one vote, that every vote counts. And I wonder, what about the Republican voter in California? What about his or her protest vote? What about the Democratic voter in Idaho? What about his or her protest vote and ensuring that those votes show up in the national column? Under our winner-take-all system of electoral college assignment, they do not. The Electoral College may function seamlessly from a technical standpoint, but I think few Americans looking at outcomes where a majority of voters in this country voted one way and someone else was elected would believe it functioned well. Recounts, again, important issue. The statistical likelihood of a national recount, an election so close, within that 0.1% or half of a tenth of 5,000 0.05 of a percent that it would seem to require a national recount is so much smaller than the possibility that we would get a Florida situation or what we came to very close to in Ohio in 2004. So the likelihood of a national recount under this system is much, much lower. Bottom line is, this is an attempt to assure that every American's vote counts. Let me say one final sort of personal word about this. As you know, I teach middle schoolers. I teach 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. Among the things I teach is U.S. government, U.S. history. And I would rarely defend a bill or a position by saying, well, it's right because it's simple, it's comprehensible. That would be hard defense of a lot of the things that we do here. But there are some things about U.S. government that should be simple enough that a seventh grader can understand it pretty easily. There are some things, not most. There are some things that are quite appropriately complex, but there are some things that you or I ought to be able to go into a classroom of seventh graders, spend an hour talking about, and that they ought to understand, most of them ought to understand pretty clearly. And I would venture to say the election of the U.S. president ought to be based on principles that are simple enough that the majority of an average class of seventh graders can understand it after an hour. It may be the fault of my own teaching that I have struggled to explain both the workings and rationale of our electoral college system, but I suspect it has something to do with the fact that our country has evolved to such an extent beyond and away from what the founders intended when they developed the system. So I appreciate your time and attention and real thoughtful deliberation on this important and challenging issue, and would appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Schaffler, how do you vote? Schaffler votes no. Representative Holvey, how do you vote? Holvey votes aye. Representative Barton, how do you vote? Barton votes aye. Representative Stiegler, how do you vote? Stiegler votes no. House Bill 2588, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2621, relating to ballots and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2621. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today, we have the opportunity to fix a problem in our election system that has come up in a couple different times. And that has to do with the fact that we mail ballots with two different dates. So currently the federal government requires us to mail overseas ballots to our military working overseas and other out-of-country people 45 days before the election. And we have a state statute that requires them to mail them 30 days before the election. A situation took place in Coos County in which a judge was killed in a motorcycle accident between those two dates. So they decided, what's the remedy? Well, the remedy turned out to be that you had to take all the ballots that had not been mailed and make a line through the name of the judge to clear it, and then to send a new ballot out to all of the people who were in the military, which means another printing with the line scribed through it for them, so they would get the same ballot that the people here voting got, albeit a little bit later than the first time they got the ballot. In Washington County, they talked about the fact that in their situation in which this happened, they had to, if the ballots had already been sent off to the company that was going to do it for them, they have to get them back, and they go out of the line with a number of people who use the same mailing house. All of a sudden, theirs are taken out of that list so they can open the ballots and make the line through it, and then buy new envelopes and put them back in envelopes and mail it out. And so what this bill does is simply put the two dates together, and on 47 days, if a person were to pass away 47 days before, then we could take care of that in the 2 days we have to get them out, and we don't have this situation happening where the fact that it happens between two dates creates this extra expense for our people. I would encourage your aye vote on House Bill 2621.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Rubland, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. House Bill 2621, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Final reading, memorials, and resolutions. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 181, relating to tax treatment of expense for use of indigenable property paid to a related member. Senate Bill 202, relating to construction contractors. Senate Bill 605, relating to nurses.
Bills read first time are passed to the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 160, relating to HIV testing of individuals in state institutions, and declaring an emergency.
Bill read second time is passed to third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. Other business of the House. Other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Call.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I rise today just briefly to say I am filled with pride not only to hear the great music from my alma mater today sung for us, and I have a Bachelor of Music, so they come from my department, but even greater pride, well, maybe equal pride, that last night the Portland State Vikings won the Big Sky Conference Championship, and they're going to the dance. May they not be the last Oregon team to make it there.
Further announcements. Representative Wingard.
Colleagues, tonight a battle will take place in Eugene between a school from my district and from the representative from the Emerald Empire. The Wilsonville Wildcats boys basketball team will be playing in the 5A state playoffs against Churchill High School, who comes in with the number one seed, but I believe, especially in this session, in underdogs, go Wildcats.
Further announcements? Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the same subject of basketball, in the NAIA District 2 National Basketball Tournament Championship, the defending national champions, the Oregon Tech Owls from Klamath Falls, defeated Iowa Westland last night, 69-47. Advance on to the quarterfinals. Warner Pacific and Eastern Oregon, two other Oregon schools, will play their first games this afternoon, and we wish them well.
Further announcements. Remonstrances. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, permission to use a visual aid?
Representative Galizia requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended, that he be allowed to use a visual aid. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, about two hours ago, well, actually probably about three, I walked to my office and I found this ominous-looking brown bag on my desk. And my first thought was, since I oppose House Bill 3274, the tax on medicinal marijuana, that it was a gift from the representative from Josephine County in an attempt to influence my vote, a bag of medicine. I was relieved, actually a little disappointed, that it wasn't that. My staff then informed me that the representative from Oregon's Christmas Tree District had brought a gift over. My first thought was, oh, it's hydrogen. But when I looked inside, I found this beautiful blue blanket for my now seven-week-old son, Giovanni. And when I told the representative from Beaverton, Aloha, that I'd gotten this blanket from the representative from the Oregon's Christmas Tree District, he asked me if it was a wet blanket, and I told him no. And I did, I would like you to know, berate him for impugning the character of the Oregon, the representative from the Oregon Christmas Trees District, as if he was some kind of a joker. Now, granted, this blanket was manufactured in China. But hey, so is probably some of the medicine that the representative from Josephine County wants to tax. But anyway, this long-winded story, in a day where there's a lot of wind, I noticed that it is a blue blanket, so I appreciate the color. And I just wanted to say bipartisanship is still alive and well to some degree, and I wanted to thank the representative and his wife for the beautiful gift. Thank you very much.
Further remonstrances? Adjournment. Representative Tomei, 10:15.
Finally. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until Monday, the 16th of March at 10:15 a.m.
Representative Tomei moves the House adjourn until 10:15, Monday, March 16, 2009. Without objection, the House is adjourned.